Although I sold a couple of stories as a college student, my career as a professional fiction writer actually began just after my graduation. I had written a column, King's Garbage Truck it was called, the editor-in-chief's name for it, not mine, in the college paper for 2 or 3 years, and I stopped into the offices to pick up some of my junk 2 or 3 days after commencement. The place was totally empty, the first time I'd ever seen it that way. For a week or so, I'd had a story idea knocking around in my head, something about giant rats living and breeding under a New England textile mill. It wasn't a bit like the sensitive literary fiction I'd been doing in the creative writing seminars I had taken, not much like the slap-happy, sarcastic columns I'd written for the Garbage Truck, but that big, empty office and all those empty typewriters suggested a liberation and an openness I'd only guessed at during my last couple of semesters. They suggested I could do what I wanted. Wasn't school out? I spent that day knocking out a story called Graveyard Shift. I remember being very happy and very absorbed, having the time of my life, in fact. The story was gruesome, fast, and fun. It later became a film, which was gruesome and fast, but unfortunately, not much fun. I sent it out to Cavalier Magazine, pretty much as it was. I might have put it through one fast rewrite, although I don't remember doing so. My writer's market said Cavalier would read unagented horror and science fiction stories, and that was good enough for me. It turned out to be good enough for Nye Wilden, the fiction editor at Cavalier, too. He bought it for $200, which seemed an enormous amount of money to a young man who had spent most of his college years in 2 pairs of blue jeans and had on more than one occasion supped on cheery casserole, a dish I invented. It consisted of Cheerios and peanut butter fried in Wesson oil. Ever had any? No? Good for you. By the time the check for Graveyard Shift arrived, I was engaged to be married. My intended, Tabitha Spruce of Old Town, Maine, enjoyed my stories a good deal, as I enjoyed her work, mostly poetry at that time. I met her while we were working together at the Raymond Fogler Library at the University of Maine, but really got to know her in a series of poetry seminars and workshops. She read a story of mine called I Am the Doorway in the early fall of 1970, and said it was one of the best science fiction stories she'd ever read. I was flattered out of my socks, not to mention the rest of my apparel. That story also sold to Cavalier, and by the time it was published, we were married. By 1973, we had a couple of kids. All that flattering each other out of our socks had inevitable consequences. And my short story sales to the men's magazines had become crucial to our financial survival. I began our partnership as a laundry worker and progressed to teaching high school English. Neither was quite enough for a family of four, but with the extra $1,200 or so from short story sales, we were able to get by. It got to the point where, when one of the kids got an ear infection and we needed to buy antibiotics, Tabby would say, half joking and half not, "Hurry up, Steve, think of a monster." In the late fall or early winter of 1972, I had an idea for a short story about a girl with telekinetic, or psychokinetic if you prefer, powers. The idea had actually been kicking around in my head since high school when I read a Life magazine article about a case of poltergeist activity in a suburban home. Poltergeists are frisky or teasing spirits, ghosts if you want to call a spook. The activity in this house seemed, on closer examination, to have nothing to do with ghosts. There was a troubled teenage girl in the family. When she was home, objects, particularly religious objects, flew through the air. When she was away, things stayed where they belonged. The article hazarded the theory that much of the activity ascribed to ghosts is actually caused by kids, and that girls on the brink of puberty seem especially apt to tap into this wild talent. The idea seemed to be that there was a great force within them, accessible only at this time of life. I thought it would make a good story, maybe worth as much as $500, and started to write it, working in the laundry room of our little trailer. In those days, I couldn't get away from washing machines, it seemed, and typing the first draft single-spaced and with extra narrow margins, as I always did. Paper cost money, and we had none to waste on extra sheets for first drafts. Before I had completed two pages, ghosts of my own began to intrude, the ghosts of two girls, both dead, who eventually combined to become Carrie White. I will not call either by her true name here. They were unfortunates in life and do not deserve to be chewed over, even in such a humble introduction as this, in death. I will call one of them Tina White and the other Sandra Irving. Tina went to Durham Elementary School with me. This was a bucolic, four-room country school with perhaps 60 pupils in all. Tina was pudgy and quiet, so back road you could cry. There is a goat in every class, the kid who is always left without a chair in musical chairs, the one who always winds up wearing the kick me hard sign, the one who stands at the end of the pecking order. This was Tina. Not because she was stupid, she wasn't, and not because her family was peculiar, it was, but because she wore the same clothes to school every day. I can still see that outfit. I don't even need to close my eyes. There was the red hairband over the black and really quite beautiful hair. There was the white sleeveless blouse worn both summer and winter, clinging ever more tightly to the growing and quite heavy bosom. And there was the black skirt falling gracelessly to the lower part of the shin. After Christmas one year, Tina came in wearing an entirely new outfit. I can't remember that one, only how happy she was to be wearing it. I think she might have even been wearing nylons. And I can clearly remember how her hopeful vivacity changed, first into surprise, then into anger, and finally into dull acceptance, as the teasing and the insults and the sarcastic comments rained down on her. Instead of abating, the kids' rejection of Tina became even fiercer. I did not take part in this behavior, which can only be termed as hazing, but I did not speak against it. Hell, I was only 14 years old. It's hard to stand up when you're 14. Sandra Irving lived about a mile and a half from the little house where I grew up. There was no father in the picture, only her mother and a large German shepherd with the absurd name of Cheddar Cheese. Mrs. Irving hired me one day to help her move some furniture. I might have been 16 or so by then, and I was struck by the crucifix hanging in the living room over the Irving couch. If such a gigantic icon had fallen while the two of them were watching TV, the person it fell on would almost certainly have been killed. I had known that the Irvings were religious in some queer and fervent way that excluded our run-of-the-mill Methodist church, but until I saw that hideous, dominating Christo, the impaled figure on the cross running blood and freshets from hands and feet inside, eyes upturned in a grisly combination of agony and compassion, I never fully understood how religious or how strange. That religion was part of what kept kids away from Sandy. The smell of her, not dirt, but some strange powdery scent like sweet and cloying library dust, was also part of it. The fact that she suffered from epileptic seizures and wore strangely modest, old-fashioned clothes also played their parts. But, as with Tina, there was something else as well, something that broadcast, "Strange, not like us, keep away," on a wavelength only other kids can pick up. It is like a pirate radio station of the heart. I can no longer pick up on that wavelength, but I can remember it very well, as I can remember Tina's black skirt and relentlessly yellowing white sleeveless blouse. Neither girl, fortunately or unfortunately, had Carrie White's wild talent. Neither made it through high school, nor saw the age of 30. Tina committed suicide, hanging herself in her cellar. Sandy died during an epileptic seizure in the small apartment she had taken in the town where we had all gone to high school. These were the ghosts which kept trying to come between me and what I was writing, kept insisting that I combine them somehow into a story that would tell what could have happened if there really was such a thing as telekinetic energy, and for all I know, there may be. What could have happened if the world was as fair to young girls as it is hard? In short, they wanted me to write a novel. I was frightened, both of the world of girls I would have to inhabit, it was a world I knew almost nothing about, and of the level of cruelty I would have to describe. I was also frightened to revisit what I'd not had the wit or moral courage to stop. And there was a more prosaic side as well. Tabby and I needed some quick money for groceries and rent, not a novel that might or might not sell to a publisher. I threw the half-completed first pages of the story into the wastebasket and went into the living room to watch TV. Tabby asked me what I'd been working on. I told her a short story, but it had gone bust and I'd thrown it away. Perhaps she saw something in my face, I don't know for sure. All I know is that she went into my little writing room, took the pages out of the wastebasket, shook off the cigarette ashes, smoothed them out, read them, and suggested I go on. I did, mostly to please her. The result turned out to be the short novel which follows, dated now, but still with a surprising power to hurt and horrify. It was published by Doubleday in 1974 and has remained in print ever since. Sometimes, quite often in fact, I wish that Tina and Sandy were alive to read it, or their daughters.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Carrie by Stephen King. Read by Sissy Spacek. With an introduction by Stephen King. Part 1. Bloodsport.
News item from the Westover, Maine Weekly Enterprise, August 19, 1966. Rain of stones reported. It was reliably reported by several persons that a rain of stones fell from a clear blue sky on Carlin Street in the town of Chamberlain on August 17th. The stones fell principally on the home of Mrs. Margaret White, damaging the roof extensively and ruining two gutters and a downspout valued at approximately $25. Mrs. White, a widow, lives with her 3-year-old daughter, Carrietta. Mrs. White could not be reached for comment. Nobody was really surprised when it happened. Not really. Not at the subconscious level, where savage things grow. On the surface, all the girls in the shower room were shocked, thrilled, ashamed, or simply glad that the white bitch had taken it in the mouth again. Some of them might also have claimed surprise, but of course their claim was untrue. Carrie had been going to school with some of them since the first grade, and this had been building since that time, building slowly and immutably in accordance with all the laws that govern human nature, building with all the steadiness of a chain reaction approaching critical mass. What none of them knew, of course, was that Carrie White was telekinetic. Graffiti scratched on a desk of the Barker Street Grammar School in Chamberlain. Carrie White eats shit. The locker room was filled with shouts, echoes, and the subterranean sound of showers splashing on tile. The girls had been playing volleyball in period one, and their morning sweat was light and eager. Girls stretched and writhed under the hot water, squalling, flicking water, squirting white bars of soap from hand to hand. Carrie stood among them stolidly, a frog among swans. She was a chunky girl with pimples on her neck and back and buttocks, her wet hair completely without color. It rested against her face with dispirited sogginess, and she simply stood, head slightly bent, letting the water splat against her flesh and roll off. She looked the part of the sacrificial goat, the constant butt, believer in left-handed monkey wrenches, perpetual foul-up, and she was. She wished forlornly and constantly that you and I had individual and thus private showers, like the high schools at Westover or Lewiston. They stared. They always stared. Showers turning off one by one, girls stepping out, removing pastel bathing caps, toweling, spraying deodorant, checking the clock over the door. Bras were hooked. Underpants stepped in, too. Steam hung in the air. The place might have been an Egyptian bathhouse, except for the constant rumble of the jacuzzi whirlpool in the corner. Calls and catcalls rebounded, with all the snap and flicker of billiard balls after a hard break. "So Tommy said he hated it on me, and I'm going with my sister and her husband. He picks his nose, but so does she. So they're very shower after school and too cheap to spend a goddamn penny, so Cindy and I..." Miss Desjardin, their slim, non-breasted gym teacher, stepped in, craned her neck around briefly, and slapped her hands together once, smartly. "What are you waiting for, Carrie? Doom? Bell in 5 minutes." Her shorts were blinding white, her legs not too curved, but striking in their unobtrusive muscularity. A silver whistle, won in college archery competition, hung around her neck. The girls giggled, and Carrie looked up, her eyes slow and dazed from the heat and the steady pounding roar of the water. It was a strangely froggy sound, grotesquely apt, and the girls giggled again. Sue Snell had whipped a towel from her hair with the speed of a magician embarking on a wondrous feat and began to comb rapidly. Miss Desjardin made an irritated, cranking gesture at Carrie and stepped out. Carrie turned off the shower. It died in a drip and a gurgle. It wasn't until she stepped out that they all saw the blood running down her leg. From the shadow exploded, documented facts and specific conclusions derived from the case of Carrietta White by David R. Congress, Tulane University Press, 1981, page 34. It can hardly be disputed that failure to note specific instances of telekinesis during the white girl's earlier years must be attributed to the conclusion offered by White and Stearns in their paper, Telekinesis, A Wild Talent Revisited. That the ability to move objects by effort of the will alone comes to the fore only in moments of extreme personal stress. The talent is well hidden indeed. How else could it have remained submerged for centuries with only the tip of the iceberg showing above a sea of quackery? We have only skimpy hearsay evidence upon which to lay our foundation in this case, but even this is enough to indicate that a TK potential of immense magnitude existed within Carrie White. The great tragedy is that we are now all Monday morning quarterbacks. Period! The catcall came first from Chris Hargensen. It struck the tiled walls, rebounded, and struck again. Sue Snell gasped laughter from her nose and felt an odd, vexing mixture of hate, revulsion, exasperation, and pity. She just looked so dumb, standing there, not knowing what was going on. God, you think she never... Period! It was becoming a chant, an incantation. Someone in the background, perhaps Hargensen again, Sue couldn't tell in the jungle of echoes, was yelling, "Plug it up!" with hoarse, uninhibited abandon. Period! 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 Carrie stood dumbly in the center of a forming circle, water rolling from her skin in beads. She stood like a patient ox, aware that the joke was on her, as always, dumbly embarrassed but unsurprised. Sue felt welling disgust as the first dark drops of menstrual blood struck the tile in dime-sized drops. "For God's sakes, Carrie, you got your period," she cried. "Clean yourself up." She looked around bovinely, her hair stuck to her cheeks in a curving helmet shape. There was a cluster of acne on one shoulder. At 16, the elusive stamp of hurt was already marked clearly in her eyes. "She thinks they're for lipstick," Ruth Gogan suddenly shouted with cryptic glee, and then burst into a shriek of laughter. Sue remembered the comment later and fitted it into a general picture, but now it was only another senseless sound in the confusion. 16, she was thinking. "She must know what's happening. She..." More droplets of blood. Carrie still blinked around at her classmates in slow bewilderment. Helen Shires turned around and made mock throwing up gestures. "You're bleeding!" Sue yelled suddenly, furiously. "You're bleeding, you big dumb pudding!" Carrie looked down at herself. She shrieked. The sound was very loud in the humid locker room. A tampon suddenly struck her in the chest and fell with a plop at her feet. A red flower stained the absorbent cotton and spread. Then the laughter, disgusted, contemptuous, horrified, seemed to rise and bloom into something jagged and ugly, and the girls were bombarding her with tampons and sanitary napkins, some from purses, some from the broken dispenser on the wall. They flew like snow, and the chant became, "Plug it up! Plug it up! Plug it up! Plug it!" Sue was throwing them too, throwing and chanting with the rest, not really sure what she was doing. A charm had occurred to her mind, and it glowed there like neon. "There's no harm in it, really. No harm in it, really. No harm." It was still flashing and glowing, reassuringly, when Carrie suddenly began to howl and back away, flailing her arms and grunting and gobbling. The girls stopped, realizing that fission and explosion had finally been reached. It was at this point, when looking back, that some of them would claim surprise. Yet there had been all these years of, "Let's short sheet Carrie's bed at Christian youth camp. And I found this love letter from Carrie to flash Bobby Pickett. Let's copy it and pass it around and hide her underpants somewhere and put this snake in her shoe and duck her again, duck her again." Carrie, tagging along stubbornly on biking trips, known one year as Puddin' and the next year as Truck Face, always smelling sweaty, not able to catch up, catching poison ivy from urinating in the bushes and everyone finding out. "Hey, Scratch Ash, your bum itch?" Billy Preston putting peanut butter in her hair that time she fell asleep in study hall. The pinches, the legs outstretched in school aisles to trip her up. The books knocked from her desk. The obscene postcard tucked into her purse. Carrie on the church picnic and kneeling down clumsily to pray. And the seam of her old madras skirt splitting along the zipper like the sound of a huge wind breakage. Carrie always missing the ball, even in kickball, falling on her face in modern dance during their sophomore year and chipping a tooth, running into the net during volleyball, wearing stockings that were always running or about to run, always showing sweat stains under the arms of her blouse, even the time Chris Hargensen called up after school from the Kelly Fruit Company downtown and ask her if she knew that pig poop was spelled C-A-R-R-I-E. Suddenly, all this and the critical mass was reached. The ultimate shit-on, gross-out, put-down, long-searched-for was found. Fission. She backed away, howling in the new silence, fat forearms crossing her face, a tampon stuck in the middle of her pubic hair. The girls watched her, their eyes shining solemnly. Carrie backed into the side of one of the four large shower compartments and slowly collapsed into a sitting position. Slow, helpless groans jerked out of her. Her eyes rolled with wet whiteness, like the eyes of a hog in the slaughtering pen. Sue said slowly, hesitantly, "I think this must be the first time she ever..." That was when the door pumped open with a flat and hurried bang, and Miss Desjardin burst in to see what the matter was. From The Shadow Exploded, page 41. Both medical and psychological writers on the subject are in agreement that Carrie White's exceptionally late and traumatic commencement of the menstrual cycle might well have provided the trigger for her latent talent. It seems incredible that, as late as 1979, Carrie knew nothing of the mature woman's monthly cycle. It is nearly as incredible to believe that the girl's mother would permit her daughter to reach the age of nearly 17 without consulting a gynecologist concerning the daughter's failure to menstruate. Yet the facts are incontrovertible. When Carrie White realized she was bleeding from the vaginal opening, she had no idea of what was taking place. She was innocent of the entire concept of menstruation. One of her surviving classmates, Ruth Gogan, tells of entering the girls' locker room at UN High School the year before the events we're concerned with, and seeing Carrie using a tampon to blot her lipstick with. At that time, Miss Gogan said, "What the hell are you up to?" Miss White replied, "Isn't this right?" Miss Gogan then replied, "Sure, sure it is." Ruth Gogan let a number of her girlfriends in on this. She later told this interviewer she thought it was sort of cute. And if anyone tried in the future to inform Carrie of the true purpose of what she was using to make up with, she apparently dismissed the explanation as an attempt to pull her leg. This was a facet of her life that she had become exceedingly wary of. When the girls were gone to their period two classes and the bell had been silenced, several of them had slipped quietly out the back door before Miss Desjardin could begin to take names. Miss Desjardin employed the standard tactic for hysterics. She slapped Carrie smartly across the face. She hardly would have admitted the pleasure the act gave her, and she certainly would have denied that she regarded Carrie as a fat, whiny bag of lard. A first-year teacher, she still believed that she thought all children were good. Carrie looked up at her dumbly, face still contorted and working. "Get up," Miss Desjardin said dispassionately. "Get up and tend to yourself." "I'm bleeding to death," Carrie screamed, and one blind, searching hand came up and clutched Miss Desjardin's white shorts. It left a bloody handprint. The gym teacher's face contorted into a pucker of disgust, and she suddenly hurled Carrie, stumbling to her feet. "Get over there!" Carrie stood swaying between the showers and the wall, with its dime sanitary napkin dispenser, slumped over, breasts pointing at the floor, her arms dangling limply. She looked like an ape. Her eyes were shiny and blank. "Now," Miss Desjardin said with a hissing, deadly emphasis, "you take one of those napkins out. No, never mind the coin slot. It's broken anyway. Take one. Damn it, will you do it? You act as if you never had a period before." "Period," Carrie said. Her expression of complete unbelief was too genuine, too full of dumb and hopeless horror to be ignored or denied. A terrible and black foreknowledge grew in Rita Desjardin's mind. It was incredible. Could not be. She herself had begun menstruation shortly after her 11th birthday and had gone to the head of the stairs to yell down excitedly, "Hey, Mom, I'm on the rag!" "Carrie?" she said now. She advanced toward the girl. "Carrie." Carrie flinched away. At the same instant, a rack of softball bats in the corner fell over with a large echoing bang. They rolled every which way, making Desjardin jump. "Carrie, is this your first period?" But now that the thought had been admitted, she hardly had to ask.
The blood was dark and flowing with terrible heaviness. Both of Carrie's legs were smeared and splattered with it as though she had waded through a river of blood. "It hurts," Carrie groaned. "My stomach."
"That passes," Miss Disjardin said. Pity and self-shame met in her and mixed uneasily. "You have to stop the flow of blood. There was a bright flash overhead, followed by a flash gun-like pop as a light bulb sizzled and went out. Miss Disjardin cried out with surprise, and it occurred to her, the whole damn place is falling in, that this kind of thing always seemed to happen around Carrie when she was upset, as if bad luck dogged her every step. The thought was gone almost as quickly as it had come. She took one of the sanitary napkins from the broken dispenser and unwrapped it. "Look," she said, "like this." From The Shadow Exploded, page 54. Carrie White's mother, Margaret White, gave birth to her daughter on September 21, 1963, under circumstances which can only be termed bizarre. In fact, an overview of the Carrie White case leaves the careful student with one feeling ascendant over all others, that Carrie was the only issue of a family as odd as any that has ever been brought to popular attention. As noted earlier, Ralph White died in February of 1963 when a steel girder fell out of a carrying sling on a housing project job in Portland. Mrs. White continued to live alone in their suburban Chamberlain bungalow. Due to the Whites' near-fanatical, fundamentalist religious beliefs, Mrs. White had no friends to see her through her period of bereavement, and when her labor began 7 months later, she was alone. At approximately 1:30 p.m. on September 21st, the neighbors on Carlin Street began to hear screams from the White bungalow. The police, however, were not summoned to the scene until after 6 p.m. We are left with two unappetizing alternatives to explain this time lag. Either Mrs. White's neighbors on the street did not wish to become involved in a police investigation, or dislike for her had become so strong that they deliberately adopted a wait-and-see attitude. Mrs. Georgia McLaughlin, the only one of three remaining residents who were on the street at that time and who would talk to me, said that she did not call the police because she thought the screams had something to do with Holy Roland. When the police did arrive at 6:22 p.m., the screams had become irregular. Mrs. White was found in her bed upstairs, and the investigating officer, Thomas G. Merton, at first thought she had been the victim of an assault. The bed was drenched with blood, and a butcher knife lay on the floor. It was only then that he saw the baby, still partially wrapped in the placental membrane, at Mrs. White's breast. She had apparently cut the umbilical cord herself with the knife. It staggers both imagination and belief to advance the hypothesis that Mrs. Margaret White did not know she was pregnant or even understand what the word entails, and recent scholars such as J.W. Bankson and George Fielding have made a more reasonable case for the hypothesis that the concept, linked irrevocably in her mind with the sin of intercourse, had been blocked entirely from her mind. She may simply have refused to believe that such a thing could happen to her. We have records of at least three letters to a friend in Kenosha, Wisconsin, that seem to prove conclusively that Mrs. White believed, from her 5th month on, that she had a cancer of the womanly parts and would soon join her husband in heaven. When Miss Disjardin led Carrie up to the office 15 minutes later, the halls were mercifully empty. Classes droned onward behind closed doors. Carrie's shrieks had finally ended, but she had continued to weep with steady regularity. Disjardin had finally placed the napkin herself, cleaned the girl up with wet paper towels, and gotten her back into her plain cotton underpants. She tried twice to explain the commonplace reality of menstruation, but Carrie clapped her hands over her ears and continued to cry. Mr. Morton, the assistant principal, was out of his office in a flash when they entered. Billy DeLoyce and Henry Trennant, two boys waiting for the lecture due them for cutting French 1, goggled around from their chairs. "Come in," Mr. Morton said briskly. "Come right in."
He glared over Desjardins' shoulder at the boys who were staring at the bloody handprint on her shorts. "What are you looking at?" "Blood," Henry said and smiled with a kind of vacuous surprise. "Two detention periods," Morton snapped. He glanced down at the bloody handprint and blinked. He closed the door behind them and began pawing through the top drawer of his filing cabinet for a school accident form. "Are you all right, Carrie?" Desjardins supplied. "Carrie White." Mr. Morton had finally located an accident form. There was a large coffee stain on it. "You won't need that, Mr. Morton." "Oh, I suppose it was a trampoline. I won't?" "No, but I think Carrie should be allowed to go home for the rest of the day. She's had a rather frightening experience." Her eyes flashed a signal which he caught, but could not interpret. Okay, if you say so." "Good. Fine." Morton crumpled the form back into the filing cabinet, slammed it shut with his thumb in the drawer, and grunted. He whirled gracefully to the door, yanked it open, glared at Billy and Henry, and called, "Miss Fish, could we have a dismissal slip here, please? Carrie Wright." "White," said Miss Desjardins. "White," Morton agreed. Billy DeLois sniggered. "Week's detention," Morton barked. A blood blister was forming under his thumbnail. Hurt like hell. Carrie's steady, monotonous weeping went on and on. Miss Fish brought the yellow dismissal slip, and Morton scrawled his initials on it with his silver pocket pencil, wincing at the pressure on his wounded thumb. "Do you need a ride, Cassie?" he asked. "We can call a cab if you need one." She shook her head. He noticed with distaste that a large bubble of green mucus had formed at one nostril. Morton looked over her head and at Miss Desjardins. "I'm sure she'll be all right," she said. "Carrie only has to go over to Carlin Street. The fresh air will do her good." Morton gave the girl the yellow slip. "You can go now, Cassie," he said magnanimously. "That's not my name," she screamed suddenly. Morton recoiled, and Miss Desjardins jumped as if struck from behind. The heavy ceramic ashtray on Morton's desk, it was Rodin's Thinker, with his head turned into a receptacle for cigarette butts, suddenly toppled to the rug as if to take cover from the force of her scream. Butts and flakes of Morton's pipe tobacco scattered on the pale green nylon rug. "Now listen," Morton said, trying to muster sternness. "I know you're upset, but that doesn't mean I'll stand for..." "Please," Miss Desjardins said quietly. Morton blinked at her and then nodded curtly. He tried to project the image of a lovable John Wayne figure while performing the disciplinary functions that were his main job as assistant principal, but did not succeed very well. The administration, usually represented at J.C. suppers, PTA functions, and American Legion award ceremonies by Principal Henry Grail, usually termed him Lovable Mort. The student body was more apt to call him that crazy ass jabber from the office. But as few students, such as Billy DeLois and Henry Trent, PTA functions or town meetings, the administration's view tended to carry the day. Now Lovable Mort, still secretly nursing his jammed thumb, smiled at Carrie and said, "Go along then if you like, Miss Wright. Or would you like to sit and just collect yourself?" "I'll go," she muttered and swiped her hair. She got up, then looked around at Miss Desjardins. Her eyes were wide open and dark with knowledge. "They laughed at me, threw things. They've always laughed." Desjardins could only look at her helplessly. Carrie left. For a moment there was silence. Morton and Desjardins watched her go. Then, with an awkward throat-clearing sound, Mr. Morton hunkered down carefully and began to sweep together the debris from the fallen ashtray. What was that all about? She sighed and looked at the drying maroon handprint on her shorts with distaste. She got her period, her first period, in the shower. Morton cleared his throat again, and his cheeks went pink. The sheet of paper he was sweeping with moved even faster. "Isn't she a bit, old for her first?" "Yes, that's what made it so traumatic for her. Although I can't understand why her mother..." The thought trailed off, forgotten for the moment. I don't think I handled it very well, Morty. But I didn't understand what was going on. She thought she was bleeding to death. He stared up sharply. I don't believe she knew there was such a thing as menstruation until half an hour ago. Hand me that little brush there, Mistress Jordan. Yes, that's it. She handed him a little brush with a legend, Chamberlain Hardware and Lumber Company Never Brushes You Off, written up the handle. He began to brush his pile of ashes onto the paper. Well, there's still going to be some for the vacuum cleaner, I guess. This deep pile is miserable. I thought I set that ashtray back on the desk further. Funny how things fall over. He bumped his head on the desk and sat up abruptly. It's hard for me to believe that a girl in this or any other high school could get through 3 years and still be alien to the fact of menstruation, Miss Disjardin. It's even more difficult for me, she said. But it's all I can think of to explain her reaction. And she's always been a group scapegoat. He funneled the ashes and butts into the wastebasket and dusted his hands. Oh, I've placed her, I think. White. Margaret White's daughter. Must be. That makes it a little easier to believe. He sat down behind his desk and smiled apologetically. There's so many of them. After 5 years or so, they all start to merge into one group face. You call boys by their brothers' names, that type of thing. It's hard. Of course it is. Wait till you've been in the game 20 years like me, he said morosely, looking down at his blood blister. You get kids that look familiar and find out you had their daddy the year you started teaching. Margaret White was before my time, for which I am profoundly grateful. She told Mrs. Bacenti, God rest her, that the Lord was reserving a special burning seat in hell for her because she gave the kids an outline of Mr. Darwin's beliefs on evolution. She was suspended twice while she was here, once for beating a classmate with her purse. Legend has it that Margaret saw the classmate smoking a cigarette. Peculiar religious views. Very peculiar. His John Wayne expression suddenly snapped down. The other girls, did they really laugh at her? Sanitary napkins at her when I walked in, throwing them like peanuts. Oh dear. John Wayne disappeared. Mr. Morton went. That's not all of them, although some of them may rat on the rest. Christine Hargensen appeared to be the ringleader, as usual. Chris and her Mortimer snerds, Martin murmured. Yes, Tina Blake, Rachel Spies, Helen Shires, Donna Thibodeau and her sister Mary Lila Grace, Jessica Upshaw, and Sue Snell. She frowned. You wouldn't expect a trick like that from Sue. She's never seen the type for this kind of a stunt. Did you talk to the girls involved? Miss Disjardin chuckled unhappily. I got them the hell out of there. I was too flustered, and Carrie was having hysterics. He steepled his fingers. Do you plan to talk to them? Yes. But she sounded reluctant. Do I detect a note of... You probably do, she said glumly. I'm living in a glass house, see. I understand how those girls felt. The whole thing just made me want to take the girl and shake her. Maybe there's some kind of instinct about menstruation that makes women want to snarl. I don't know. I keep seeing Sue Snell and the way she looked. Mr. Morton repeated wisely. He did not understand women and had no urge at all to discuss menstruation. I'll talk to them tomorrow, she promised, rising. Rip them down one side and up the other. Good. Make the punishment suit the crime, and if you feel you have to send any of them to me, feel free. I will, she said kindly. By the way, a light blew out while I was trying to calm her down. It added the final touch. I'll send a janitor right down, he promised. And thanks for doing your best, Miss Disjardin. Will you have Miss Fish send in Billy and Henry? Certainly. She left. He leaned back and let the whole business slide out of his mind. When Billy Delois and Henry Trennant, class cutters extraordinaire, slunk in, he glowered at them happily and prepared to talk tough. As he often told Hank Grail, he ate class cutters for lunch. Graffiti scratched on a desk in Chamberlain Junior High School. Roses are red, violets are blue, sugar is sweet, but Carrie White eats shit. She walked down Ewan Avenue and crossed over to Carlin at the stoplight on the corner. Her head was down, and she was trying to think of nothing. Cramps came and went in great, gripping waves, making her slow down and speed up like a car with carburetor trouble. She stared at the sidewalk, quartz glittering in the cement, hopscotch grids scratched in ghostly rain-faded chalk, wads of gum stamped flat, pieces of tin foil and penny candy wrappers. They all hate and they never stop. They never get tired of it. A penny lodged in a crack. She kicked it. Imagine Chris Hargensen all bloody and screaming for mercy, with rats crawling all over her face. Good. Good. That would be good. A dog turd with a foot track in the middle of it. A roll of blackened caps that some kid had banged with a stone. Cigarette butts. Crash in her head with a rock. With a boulder. Crash in all their heads. Good. Good. Savior Jesus, meek and mild. That was good for Mama. All right for her. She didn't have to go among the wolves every day of every year, out into a carnival of laughers, joke-tellers, pointers, snickerers. And didn't Mama say there would be a day of judgment? The name of that star shall be Wormwood, and they shall be scourged with scorpions. And an angel with a sword? If only it would be today, and Jesus coming not with a lamb and a shepherd's crook, but with a boulder in each hand to crush the laughers and the snickerers, to root out the evil and destroy it, screaming, a terrible Jesus of blood and righteousness. And if only she could be his sword and his arm. She had tried to fit. She had defied Mama in 100 little ways. Had tried to erase the red plague circle that had been drawn around her from the first day she'd left the controlled environment of the small house on Carlin Street and had walked up to the Barker Street Grammar School with her Bible under her arm. She could still remember that day, the stairs, and the sudden, awful silence when she had gotten down on her knees before lunch in the school cafeteria. The laughter had begun on that day and had echoed up through the years. The red plague circle was like blood itself. You could scrub and scrub and scrub, and still it would be there, not erased, not clean. She had never gotten on her knees in a public place again, although she had not told Mama that. Still, the original memory remained, with her and with them. She had fought Mama tooth and nail over the Christian youth camp and had earned the money to go herself by taking in sewing. Mama told her darkly that it was sin, that it was Methodists and Baptists and Congregationalists, and that it was sin and backsliding. She forbade Carrie to swim at the camp. Yet, although she had swum and had laughed when they ducked her, until she couldn't get her breath anymore and they kept doing it, and she got panicky and began to scream, and had tried to take part in the camp's activities. 1,000 practical jokes had been played on old Praying Carrie, and she had come home on the bus a week early, her eyes red and socketed from weeping, to be picked up by Mama at the station, and Mama had told her grimly that she should treasure the memory of her scourging as proof that Mama knew that Mama was right, that the only hope of safety and salvation was inside the red circle. For straight is the gate, Mama had said grimly in the taxi, and at home she had sent Carrie to the closet for 6 hours. Mama had, of course, forbade her to shower with the other girls. Carrie had hidden her shower things in her school locker and had showered anyway, taking part in a naked ritual that was shameful and embarrassing to her, in hopes that the circle around her might fade a little, just a little. But today, oh, today. Tommy Erbter, age 5, was biking up the other side of the street. He was a small, intense-looking boy on a 20-inch Schwinn with bright red training wheels. He was humming Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? Under his breath. He saw Carrie, brightened, and stuck out his tongue. "Hey, old fart-face, old praying Carrie!" Carrie glared at him with sudden smoking rage. The bike wobbled on its training wheels and suddenly fell over. Tommy screamed. The bike was on top of him. Carrie smiled and walked on. The sound of Tommy's wails was sweet, jangling music in her ears. If only she could make something like that happen whenever she liked. Just did. She stopped dead, 7 houses up from her own, staring blankly at nothing. Behind her, Tommy was climbing tearfully back onto his bike, nursing a scraped knee. He yelled something at her, but she ignored it. She had been yelled at by experts. She had been thinking, "Fall off that bike, kid, push you off that bike and split your rotten head." And something had happened. Her mind had, she groped for a word, had flexed. That was not just right, but it was very close. There had been a curious mental bending, almost like an elbow curling a dumbbell. That wasn't exactly right either, but it was all she could think of. An elbow with no strength, a weak baby muscle. Flex. She suddenly stared fiercely at Mrs. Yorty's big picture window. She thought, "Stupid, frumpy old bitch, break that window." Nothing. Mrs. Yorty's picture window glittered serenely in the fresh 9 o'clock glow of morning. Another cramp gripped Carrie's belly, and she walked on. But the light. And the ashtray. Don't forget the ashtray. She looked back. "Old bitch hates my mama." Over her shoulder. Again it seemed that something flexed, but very weakly. The flow of her thoughts shuddered, as if there had been a sudden bubbling from a wellspring deeper inside. The picture window seemed to ripple. Nothing more. It could have been her eyes. Could have been. Her head began to feel tired and fuzzy, and it throbbed with the beginning of a headache. Her eyes were hot, as if she had just sat down and read the Book of Revelation straight through. She continued to walk down the street toward the small white house with the blue shutters. The familiar hate-love-dread feeling was churning inside her. Ivy had crawled up the west side of the bungalow. They always called it the bungalow because the White House sounded like a political joke, and Mama said all politicians were crooks and sinners and would eventually give the country over to the godless Reds, who would put all the believers of Jesus, even the Catholics, up against the wall. And the ivy was picturesque. She knew it was, but sometimes she hated it. Sometimes, like now, the ivy looked like a grotesque giant hand ridged with great veins which had sprung up out of the ground to grip the building. She approached it with dragging feet. Of course, there had been the stones. She stopped again, blinking vapidly at the day. The stones. Mama never talked about that. Carrie didn't even know if her mama still remembered the day of the stones. It was surprising that she herself still remembered it. She had been a very little girl then. How old? 3? 4? There had been that girl in the white bathing suit, and then the stones came, and things had flown in the house. Here the memory was, suddenly bright and clear, as if it had been there all along, just below the surface, waiting for a kind of mental puberty. Waiting, maybe, for today. From Carrie, The Black Dawn of TK, Esquire Magazine, September 12, 1980, by Jack Gaver. Estelle Horan has lived in the neat San Diego suburb of Parrish for 12 years, and outwardly, she is typical Ms. California. She wears bright print shifts and smoked amber sunglasses. Her hair is black-streaked blonde. She drives a neat maroon Volkswagen Formula V with a smile decal on the gas cap and a green flag ecology sticker on the back window. Her husband is an executive at the parish branch of the Bank of America. Her son and daughter are certified members of the Southern California Sun and Fun crowd, burnished brown beach creatures. There's a hibachi in the small, beautifully kept backyard, and the door chimes play a tinkly phrase from the refrain of Hey Jude. But Ms. Horan still carries the thin, difficult soil of New England somewhere inside her. And when she talks of Carrie White, her face takes on an odd, pinched look that is more like Lovecraft out of Arkham than Kerouac out of Southern Cal. Of course she was strange, Estelle Horan tells me, lighting a second Virginia Slim a moment after stubbing out her first. The whole family was strange. Ralph was a construction worker, and people on the street said he carried a Bible and a .38 revolver to work with him every day. The Bible was for his coffee break and lunch. The .38 was in case he met Antichrist on the job. I can remember the Bible myself. The revolver? Who knows? He was a big olive-skinned man with his hair always shaved into a flat-top crew cut. He always looked mean, and you didn't meet his eyes. Not ever. They were so intense they actually seemed to glow. When you saw him coming, you crossed the street and you never stuck out your tongue at his back. Not ever. That's how spooky he was. She pauses, puffing clouds of cigarette smoke toward the pseudo-redwood beams that cross the ceiling. Stella Horan lived on Carlin Street until she was 20, commuting to day classes at Lewin Business College in Motton. But she remembers the incident of the stones very clearly. There are times, she says, when I wonder if I might have caused it. Their backyard was next to ours, and Mrs. White had put in a hedge, but it hadn't grown out yet. She'd called my mother dozens of times about the show I was putting on in my backyard. Well, my bathing suit was perfectly decent, prudish by today's standards, nothing but a plain old one-piece Janssen. Mrs. White used to go on and on about what a scandal it was for her baby. My mother, well, she tries to be polite, but her temper is so quick. I don't know what Margaret White said to finally push her over the edge. Call me the whore of Babylon, I suppose. But my mother told her our yard was our yard, and I'd go out and dance the hoochie-coochie buck naked if that was her pleasure and mine. She also told her that she was a dirty old woman with a can of worms for a mind. There was a lot more shouting, but that was the upshot of it. I wanted to stop sunbathing right then. I hate trouble. It upsets my stomach. But Mom, when she gets a case, she's a terror. She came home from Jordan Marsh with a little white bikini, told me I might as well get all the sun I could. After all, she said, the privacy of our own backyard and all. Stella Horan smiles a little at the memory and crushes out her cigarette. I tried to argue with her, tell her I didn't want any more trouble, didn't want to be a pawn in their back fence war. Didn't do a bit of good. Trying to stop my mom when she gets a bee in her head is like trying to stop a Mack truck going downhill with no brakes. Actually, there was more to it. I was scared of the Whites. Real religious nuts are nothing to fool with. Sure, Ralph White was dead, but what if Margaret still had that .38 around? But there I was on Saturday afternoon, spread out on a blanket in the backyard, covered with suntan lotion and listening to Top 40 on the radio. Oh, Mom hated that stuff, and usually she'd yell out at least twice for me to turn it down before she went nuts. But that day she turned it up twice herself. I started to feel like the whore of Babylon myself. But nobody came out of the White's place. Not even the old lady to hang her wash. No, that's something else. She never hung any undies on the back line. Not even Carrie's, and she was only 3 back then. Always in the house. I started to relax. I guess I was thinking Margaret must have taken Carrie to the park to worship God in the raw or something. Anyway, after a little while, I rolled on my back and put one arm over my eyes and dozed off. When I woke up, Carrie was standing next to me and looking down at my body. She breaks off, frowning into space. Outside, the cars are whizzing by endlessly. I can hear the steady little whine my tape recorder makes, but it all seems a little too brittle, too glossy, just a cheap patina over a darker world, a real world where nightmares happen. She was such a pretty girl, Stella Haran resumes, lighting another cigarette. I've seen some high school pictures of her in that horrible fuzzy black and white photo on the cover of Newsweek. I look at them and all I can think is, dear God, where did she go? What did that woman do to her? Then I feel sick and sorry. She was so pretty, with pink cheeks and bright brown eyes and her hair the shade of blonde you know will darken and get mousy. Sweet is the only word that fits. Sweet and bright and innocent. Her mother's sickness hadn't touched her very deeply, not then. I kind of started up awake and tried to smile. It was hard to think what to do. I was logy from the sun and my mind felt sticky and slow. I said, hi. She was wearing a little yellow dress, sort of cute, but awfully long for a little girl in the summer. Came down to her shins. She didn't smile back. She just pointed and said, what are those? I looked down and saw that my top had slipped while I was asleep, so I fixed it and said, those are my breasts, Carrie. Then she said, very solemnly, I wish I had some. I said, you have to wait, Carrie. You won't start to get them for another, 8 or 9 years. No, I won't, she said. Mama says good girls don't. She looked strange for a little girl, half sad and half self-righteous. I could hardly believe it, and the first thing that popped into my mind also popped right out of my mouth. I said, well, I'm a good girl, and doesn't your mother have breasts? She lowered her head and said something so softly I couldn't hear it. When I asked her to repeat it, she looked at me defiantly and said that her mama had been bad when she made her, and that was why she had them. She called them dirty pillows, as if it was all one word. I couldn't believe it. I was just dumbfounded. There was nothing at all I could think to say. We just stared at each other, and what I wanted to do was grab that sad little scrap of a girl and run away with her. And that was when Margaret White came out of her back door and saw us. For a minute, she just goggled as if she couldn't believe it. Then she opened her mouth and whooped. That's the ugliest sound I've ever heard in my life. It was like the noise a bull alligator would make in a swamp. She just whooped. Rage. Complete, insane rage. Her face went just as red as the side of a fire truck, and she curled her hands into fists and whooped at the sky. She was shaking all over. I thought she was having a stroke. Her face was all scrunched up, and it was a gargoyle's face. I thought Carrie was going to faint or die on the spot. She sucked in all her breath, and that little face went a cottage cheesy color. Her mother yelled, Carrie! I jumped up and yelled back, don't you yell at her that way. You ought to be ashamed. Something stupid like that, I don't remember. Carrie started to go back, and then she stopped, and then she started again, and just before she crossed over from our lawn to there, she looked back at me, and there was a look. Oh, dreadful, I can't say it. Wanting and hating and fearing and misery. As if life itself had fallen on her like stones, all at the age of 3. My mother came out on the back stoop, and her face just crumpled when she saw the child, and Margaret, oh, she was screaming things about sluts and strumpets and the sins of the fathers being visited even unto the seventh generation. My tongue felt like a little dried-up plant. For just a second, Carrie stood swaying back and forth between the 2 yards, and then Margaret White looked upward, and I swear, sweet Jesus, that woman bayed at the sky. And then she started to hurt herself, scourge herself. She was clawing at her neck and cheeks, making red marks and scratches. She tore her dress. Carrie screamed out, "Mama," and ran to her. Mrs. White kind of squatted like a frog, and her arms swooped wide open. I thought she was going to crush her, and I screamed. The woman was grinning and drooling right down her chin. Oh, I was sick. Jesus, I was so sick. She gathered her up and they went in. I turned off my radio and I could hear her. Some of the words, but not all. You didn't have to hear all the words to know what was going on. Praying and sobbing and screeching. Crazy sounds. Margaret telling the little girl to get herself into her closet and pray. The little girl crying and screaming that she was sorry. She forgot. Then nothing. And my mother and I just looked at each other. I never saw Mom look so bad. Not even when Dad died. She said, "The child." And that was all. We went inside. She gets up and goes to the window, a pretty woman in a yellow no-back sundress. "It's almost like living it all over again, you know," she says, not turning around. I'm all riled up inside again. She laughs a little and cradles her elbows in her palms. Oh, she was so pretty. You'd never know from those pictures. Cars go by outside. Back and forth, and I sit and wait for her to go on. She reminds me of a pole vaulter eyeing the bar and wondering if it's set too high. My mother brewed a Scotch tea, strong, with milk, the way she used to when I was tomboying around and someone would push me in the nettle patch or I'd fall off my bicycle. It was awful, but we drank it anyway, sitting across from each other in the kitchen nook. She was in some old house dress with the hem falling down and back, and I was in my Whore of Babylon two-piece swimsuit. I wanted to cry, but it was too real to cry about, not like the movies. Once when I was in New York, I saw an old drunk leading a little girl in a blue dress by the hand. The girl had cried herself into a bloody nose. The drunk had gored her and his neck looked like an inner tube. There was a red bump in the middle of his forehead and a long white string on the blue serge jacket he was wearing. Everyone kept going and coming because if you did, then pretty soon you wouldn't see them anymore. That was real, too. I wanted to tell my mother that, and I was just opening my mouth to say it when the other thing happened. The thing you want to hear about, I guess. There was a big thump outside that made the glasses rattle in the china cabinet. It was a feeling as well as a sound. Thick and solid, as if someone had just pushed an iron safe off the roof. She lights a new cigarette and begins to puff rapidly. I went to the window and looked out, but I couldn't see anything. Then, when I was getting ready to turn around, something else fell. The sun glittered on it. I thought it was a big glass globe for a second. Then it hit the edge of the White's roof and shattered, and it wasn't glass at all. It was a big chunk of ice. I was going to turn around and tell Mom, and that's when they started to fall all at once, in a shower. They were falling on the White's roof, on the back and front lawn, on the outside door to their cellar. That was the sheet tin bulkhead, and when the first one hit, it made a huge bong noise, like a church bell. My mother and I both screamed. We were clutching each other like a couple of girls in a thunderstorm. Then it stopped. There was no sound at all from their house. You could see the water from the melting ice trickling down their slate shingles in the sunshine. A great big hunk of ice was stuck in the angle of the roof in their little chimney. The light on it was so bright that my eyes hurt to look at it. My mother started to ask me if it was over, and then Margaret screamed. The sound came to us very clearly. In a way, it was worse than before, because there was terror in this one. Then there were clanging, banging sounds, as if she was throwing every pot and pan in the house at the girl. The back door slammed open and slammed closed. No one came out. More screams. Mom said for me to call the police, but I couldn't move. I was stuck to the spot. Mr. Kirk and his wife Virginia came out on their lawn to look. The Smiths, too. Pretty soon, everyone on the street that was home had come out, even old Mrs. Warwick from up the block, and she was deaf in one ear. Things started to crash and tinkle and break. Bottles, glasses, I don't know what all, and then the side window broke open and the kitchen table fell halfway through. With God as my witness, it was a big mahogany thing, and it took the screen with it, and it must have weighed 300 pounds. How could a woman, even a big woman, throw that? I ask her if she is implying something. I'm only telling you, she insists, suddenly distraught. I'm not asking you to believe. She seems to catch her breath and then goes on flatly. There was nothing for maybe 5 minutes. Water was dripping out of the gutters over there, and there was ice all over the White's lawn. It was melting fast. She gives a short, chopping laugh and butts her cigarette. Why not? It was August. She wanders aimlessly back toward the sofa, then veers away. Then the stones, right out of the blue, blue sky, whistling and screaming like bombs. My mother cried out, "What in the name of God?" and put her hands over her head. But I couldn't move. I watched it all, and I couldn't move. Didn't matter anyway. They only fell on the White's property. One of them hit a downspout and knocked it onto the lawn. Others punched holes right through the roof and into the attic. The roof made a big cracking sound each time one hit, and puffs of dust would squirt up. The ones that hit the ground made everything vibrate. You could feel them hitting in your feet. Our china was tinkling, and the fancy Welsh dresser was shaking, and Mom's teacup fell on the floor and broke. They made big pits in the White's back lawn when they struck. Craters. Mrs. White hired a junk man from across town to cart them away, and Jerry Smith from up the street paid him $1 to let him chip a piece off one. He took it to BU, and they looked at it and said it was ordinary granite. One of the last ones hit a little table they had in their backyard and smashed it to pieces. But nothing, nothing that wasn't on their property was hit. She stops and turns from the window to look at me, and her face is haggard from remembering all that. One hand plays forgetfully with her casually stylish shag haircut. Not much of it got into the local paper. By the time Billy Harris came around, he reported the Chamberlain News. She had already gotten the roof fixed, and when people told him the stones had gone right through it, I think he thought we were all pulling his leg. Nobody wants to believe it. Not even now. You and all the people who'll read what you write will wish they could laugh it off and call me just another nut who's been out here in the sun too long. But it happened. There were lots of people on the block who saw it happen, and it was just as real as that drunk leading the little girl with the bloody nose. And now there's this other thing. No one can laugh that off either. Too many people are dead. And it's not just on the White's property anymore. She smiles, but there's not a drop of humor in it. She says, Ralph White was insured, and Margaret got a lot of money when he died. Double indemnity. He left the house insured, too, but she never got a penny of that. The damage was caused by an act of God. Poetic justice, huh? She laughs a little. But there's no humor in that either. Found written repeatedly on one page of a Ewan Consolidated High School notebook owned by Carrie White. Everybody's guessed that baby can't be blessed till she finally sees that she's like all the rest. Carrie went into the house and closed the door behind her. Bright daylight disappeared and was replaced by brown shadows, coolness, and the oppressive smell of talcum powder. The only sound was the ticking of the Black Forest cuckoo clock in the living room. Mama had gotten the cuckoo clock with green stamps. Once, in the sixth grade, Carrie had set out to ask Mama if green stamps weren't sinful, but her nerve had failed her. She walked up the hall and put her coat in the closet. A luminous picture above the coat hooks limned a ghostly Jesus hovering grimly over a family seated at the kitchen table. Beneath was the caption, also luminous, "The Unseen Guest." She went into the living room and stood in the middle of the faded, starting to be threadbare rug. She closed her eyes and watched the little dots flash by in the darkness. Her headache thumped queasily behind her temples. Alone. Mama worked on the speed ironer and folder down at the Blue Ribbon Laundry in Chamberlain Center. She had worked there since Carrie was 5, when the compensation in insurance that had resulted from her father's accident had begun to run out. Her hours were from 7:30 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon. The laundry was godless. Mama had told her so many times. The foreman, Mr. Elton Mott, was especially godless. Mama said that Satan had reserved a special blue corner of hell for Elt, as he was called at the Blue Ribbon. Alone. She opened her eyes. The living room contained 2 chairs with straight backs. There was a sewing table with a light where Carrie sometimes made dresses in the evening while Mama tatted doilies and talked about the coming. The Black Forest cuckoo clock was on the far wall. There were many religious pictures, but the one Carrie liked best was on the wall above her chair. It was Jesus leading lambs on a hill that was as green and smooth as the Riverside Golf Course. The others were not as tranquil. Jesus turning the money changers from the temple, Moses throwing the tablets down upon the worshippers of the golden calf, Thomas the Doubter putting his hand in Christ's wounded side. Oh, the horrified fascination of that one, and the nightmares it had given her as a girl. Noah's Ark floating above the agonized, drowning sinners. Lot and his family fleeing the great burning of Sodom and Gomorrah. On a small deal table there were a lamp and a stack of tracts. The top pamphlet showed a sinner. His spiritual status was obvious from the agonized expression on his face, trying to crawl beneath a large boulder. The title blared, "Neither shall the rock hide him on that day." But the room was actually dominated by a huge plaster crucifix on the far wall, fully 4 feet high. Mama had mail-ordered it special from St. Louis. The Jesus impaled upon it was frozen in a grotesque, muscle-straining rictus of pain, mouth drawn down in a groaning curve. His crown of thorns bled scarlet streams down temples and forehead. The eyes were turned up in a medieval expression of slanted agony. Both hands were also drenched with blood, and the feet were nailed to a small plaster platform. This corpus had also given Carrie endless nightmares in which the mutilated Christ chased her through dream corridors, holding a mallet and nails, begging her to take up her cross and follow him. Just lately, these dreams had evolved into something less understandable, but more sinister. The object did not seem to be murder, but something even more awful. Alone. The pain in her legs and belly and privates had drained away a little. She no longer thought she was bleeding to death. The word was menstruation, and all at once it seemed logical and inevitable. It was her time of the month. She giggled a strange, affrighted giggle in the solemn stillness of the living room. It sounded like a quiz show. You, too, can win an all-expenses-paid trip to Bermuda on time of the month. Like the memory of the stones, the knowledge of menstruation seemed always to have been there, blocked but waiting. She turned and walked heavily upstairs. The bathroom had a wooden floor that had been scrubbed nearly white. Cleanliness is next to godliness. And a tub on claw feet. Rust stains dripped down the porcelain below the chrome spout, and there was no shower attachment. Mama said showers were sinful. Carrie went in, opened the towel cabinet, and began to hunt purposely but carefully, not leaving anything out of place. Mama's eyes were sharp. The blue box was in the very back, behind the old towels they didn't use anymore. There was a fuzzily silhouetted woman in a long, filmy gown on the side. She took one of the napkins out and looked at it curiously. She had blotted the lipstick she snuck into her purse quite openly with these, once on a street corner. Now she remembered, or imagined she did, quizzical, shocked looks. Her face flamed. They had told her. The flush faded to a milky anger. She went into her tiny bedroom. There were many more religious pictures here, but there were more lambs and fewer scenes of righteous wrath. A UN pennant was tacked over her dresser. On the dresser itself was a Bible and a plastic Jesus that glowed in the dark. She undressed, first her blouse, then her hateful knee-length skirt, her slip, her girdle, her petty pants, her garter belt, her stockings. She looked at the pile of heavy clothes, their buttons and rubber, with an expression of fierce wretchedness. In the school library there was a stack of back issues of 17, and often she leafed through them, pasting an expression of idiotic casualness on her face. The models looked so easy and smooth in their short, kicky skirts, pantyhose, and frilly underwear with patterns on them. Of course, easy was one of Mama's pet words. She knew what Mama would say, oh, no question, to describe them. And it would make her dreadfully self-conscious. She knew that. Naked, evil, blackened with the sin of exhibitionism, the breeze blowing lewdly up the backs of her legs, inciting lust. And she knew that they would know how she felt. They always did. They would embarrass her somehow, push her savagely back down into clowndom. It was their way. She could, she knew she could be. What? In another place. She was thick through the waist, only because sometimes she felt so miserable, empty, bored, that the only way to fill that gaping, whistling hole was to eat and eat and eat. But she was not that thick through the middle. Her body chemistry would not allow her to go beyond a certain point. And she thought her legs were actually pretty, almost as pretty as Sue Snell's or Vicky Hanscom's. She could be, what, could stop the chocolates and her pimples would go down. They always did. She could fix her hair. Buy pantyhose and blue and green tights. Make little skirts and dresses from Butterick and Simplicity patterns. The price of a bus ticket, a train ticket. She could be, could be. Alive. She unsnapped her heavy cotton bra and let it fall. Her breasts were milk white, upright and smooth. The nipples were a light coffee color. She ran her hands over them, and a little shiver went through her. Evil. Bad. Oh, it was. Mama had told her there was something. The something was dangerous, ancient, unutterably evil. It could make you feeble. Watch, Mama said. It comes at night. It will make you think of the evil that goes on in parking lots and roadhouses. But though this was only 9:20 in the morning, Carrie thought that the something had come to her. She ran her hands over her breasts. Dirty pillows. Again. And the skin was cool, but the nipples were hot and hard, and when she tweaked one, it made her feel weak and dissolving. Yes, this was the something. Her underpants were spotted with blood. Suddenly she felt that she must burst into tears, scream, or rip the something out of her body, whole and beating, crush it, kill it. The napkin Miss Desjardins had fixed was already wilting, and she changed it carefully, knowing how bad she was, how bad they were, how she hated them and herself. Only Mama was good. Mama had battled the black man and had vanquished him. Carrie had seen it happen in a dream. Mama had driven him out the front door with a broom, and the black man had fled up Carlin Street into the night, his cloven feet striking red sparks from the cement. Her mama had torn the something out of herself and was pure. Carrie hated her. She caught a glimpse of her own face in the tiny mirror she had hung on the back of the door, a mirror with a cheap green plastic rim, good only for combing hair by. She hated her face, her dull, stupid, bovine face, the vapid eyes, the red, shiny pimples, the nests of blackheads. She hated her face most of all. The reflection was suddenly split by a jagged, silvery crack. The mirror fell on the floor and shattered at her feet, leaving only the plastic ring to stare at her like a blinded eye. From Ogilvie's Dictionary of Psychic Phenomena, telekinesis is the ability to move objects or to cause changes in objects by force of the mind. The phenomenon has most reliably been reported in times of crisis or in stress situations when automobiles have been levitated from pinned bodies or debris from collapsed buildings, etc. The phenomenon is often confused with the work of poltergeists, which are playful spirits. It should be noted that poltergeists are astral beings of questionable reality, while telekinesis is thought to be an empiric function of the mind, possibly electrochemical in nature. When they had finished making love, as she slowly put her clothes in order in the back seat of Tommy Ross's 1963 Ford, Sue Snell found her thoughts turning back to Carrie White. It was Friday night, and Tommy, who was looking pensively out the back window with his pants still down around his ankles, the effect was comic but oddly endearing, had taken her bowling. That, of course, was a mutually accepted excuse. Fornication had been on their minds from the word go. She had been going out more or less steadily with Tommy ever since October. It was now May, and they had been lovers for only 2 weeks. 7 times, she amended. Tonight had been the 7th. There had been no fireworks yet, no bands playing Stars and Stripes Forever, but it had gotten a little better. The first time it hurt like hell. Her girlfriends, Helen Shires and Jean Gault, had both done it, and they both assured her that it only hurt for a minute, like getting a shot of penicillin, and then it was roses. But for Sue, the first time had been like being reamed out with a hoe handle. Tommy had confessed to her sense, with a grin, that he had gotten the rubber on wrong, too. Tonight was only the second time she had begun to feel something like pleasure, and then it was over. Tommy had held out for as long as he could, but then it was just over. It seemed like an awful lot of rubbing for a little warmth. In the aftermath, she felt low and melancholy, and her thoughts turned to Carrie in this light. A wave of remorse caught her with all emotional guards down, and when Tommy turned back from the view of Brickyard Hill, she was crying. "Hey," he said, alarmed. "Oh, hey." He held her clumsily. "It's all right," she said, still weeping. "It's not you. I did a not-so-good thing today. I was just thinking of it." "What?" He patted the back of her neck gently.
So she found herself launching into the story of that morning's incident, hardly believing it was herself she was listening to. Facing the thing frankly, she realized the main reason she had allowed Tommy to have her was because she was in love, infatuation. Didn't matter, results were the same with him. And now, to put herself in this position, cohort in a nasty shower room joke, was hardly the approved method to hook a fella. And Tommy was, of course, popular. As someone who had been popular herself all her life, it had almost seemed written that she would meet and fall in love with someone as popular as she. They were almost certain to be voted king and queen of the high school spring ball, and the senior class had already voted them class couple for the yearbook. They had become a fixed star in the shifting firmament of the high school's relationships, the acknowledged Romeo and Juliet, and she knew with sudden hatefulness that there was one couple like them in every white suburban high school in America. And having something she had always longed for, a sense of place, of security, of status, she found that it carried uneasiness with it, like a darker sister. It was not the way she had conceived it. There were dark things lumbering around their warm circle of light. The idea that she had let him fuck her. Do you have to say it that way? Yes, this time I do. Simply because he was popular, for instance. The fact that they fit together walking, or that she could look at their reflection in a store window and think, there goes a handsome couple. She was quite sure, or only hopeful, that she wasn't that weak, not that liable to fall docilely into the complacent expectations of parents, friends, and even herself. But now there was this shower thing where she had gone along and pitched in with high savage glee. The word she was avoiding was expressed to conform in the infinitive, and it conjured up miserable images of hair rollers, long afternoons in front of the ironing board, in front of the soap operas while hubby was off busting heavies in an anonymous office, of joining the PTA and then the country club when their income moved into five figures, of pills in circular yellow cases without number to insure against having to move out of the missus sizes before it became absolutely necessary, and against the intrusion of repulsive little strangers who shat in their pants and screamed for help at 2 a.m, of fighting with desperate decorum to keep the niggers out of clean corners, standing shoulder to shoulder with Terry Smith, Miss Potato Blossom of 1975, and Vicki Jones, Vice President of the Women's League, armed with signs and petitions and sweet, slightly desperate smiles. Carrie. It was that goddamn Carrie. This was her fault. Perhaps before today she had heard distant circling footfalls around their lighted place. But tonight, hearing her own sordid, crummy story, she saw the actual silhouettes of all these things. And yellow eyes that glowed like flashlights in the dark. She had already bought her prom gown. It was blue. It was beautiful. You're right, he said when she was done. Bad news. Doesn't sound a bit like you. His face was grave, and she felt a cool slice of terror. Then he smiled. He had a very jolly smile, and the darkness retreated a bit. I kicked a kid in the slats once when he was knocked out. Did I ever tell you about that? She shook her head. Yeah. He rubbed his nose reminiscently, and his cheek gave a small tick. The way it had when he made his confession about getting the rubber wrong the first time. The kid's name was Danny Patrick. He beat the living shit out of me once when we were in the 6th grade. I hated him, but I was scared too. I was laying for him. You know how that is. She didn't, but she nodded anyway. Anyway, he finally picked on the wrong kid a year or so later. Pete Tabor. He was just a little guy, but he had lots of muscle. Danny got on him about something, and finally Peter just rose up righteous and beat the shit out of him. That was on the playground of the old Kennedy Junior High. Danny fell down and hit his head and went out cold. Everybody ran. We thought he might be dead.
I ran away too, but first I gave him a good kick in the ribs. Felt really bad about it afterward. You gonna apologize to her? It caught Sue flat-footed, and all she could do was clench weakly. Did you? Huh? Hell no, I had better things to do than spend my time in traction. But there's a big difference, Susie. There is? It's not seventh grade anymore, and I had some kind of reason, even if it was a piss-poor reason. What did that sad, silly bitch ever do to you? She didn't answer because she couldn't. She'd never passed more than 100 words with Carrie in her whole life, and 36 or so had come today. Phys Ed was the only class they'd had in common since they'd graduated from Chamberlain Junior High. Carrie was taking the commercial business courses. Sue, of course, was in the college division. She thought herself suddenly loathsome. She found she could not bear that, and so she twisted it at him. When did you start making all these big moral decisions? After you started fucking me? She saw the good humor fade from his face and was sorry. Guess I should have kept quiet, he said, and pulled up his pants. It's not you, it's me. She put a hand on his arm. I'm ashamed, see? I know, he said, but I shouldn't be giving advice. I'm not very good at it. Tommy, do you ever hate being so, well, popular? Me? The question wrote surprise on his face. Do you mean like football and class president and that stuff? Yes. No, it's not very important. High school isn't a very important place. When you're going, you think it's a big deal, but when it's over, nobody really thinks it was great, unless they're bearded up. That's how my brother and his buddies are anyway. It did not soothe her. It made her fears worse. Little Susie Mix and Match from Ewan High School, head cupcake of the entire cupcake brigade. Prom gown kept forever in the closet, wrapped in protective plastic. The night pressed dark against the slightly steamed car windows. I'll probably end up working at my dad's car lot, he said. I'll spend my Friday and Saturday nights down at Uncle Billy's or out at the Cavalier drinking beer and talking about the Saturday afternoon I got that fat pitch from Saunders and we upset Dorchester. Get married to some nagging broad and always own last year's model. Vote Democrat? Don't, she said, her mouth suddenly full of a dark, sweet horror. She pulled him to her. Love me. My head is so bad tonight. Love me. Love me. So he loved her, and this time it was different. This time there finally seemed to be room, and there was no tiresome rubbing, but a delicious friction that went up and up. Twice he had to stop, panting, and held himself back, and then he went again. He was a virgin before me and admitted it, I would have believed a lie. And went hard, and her breath came in short, digging gasps. And then she began to yell and hold at his back, helpless to stop, sweating, the bad taste washed away, every cell seeming to have its own climax, body filled with sunlight, musical notes in her mind, butterflies behind her skull in the cage of her mind. Later on the way home, he asked her formally if she would go to the spring ball with him. She said she would. He asked her if she had decided what to do about Carrie. She said she hadn't. He said that it made no difference, but she thought that it did. It had begun to seem that it meant all the difference. From Telekinesis, Analysis and Aftermath, Science Yearbook, 1981, by Dean D. L. McGuffin. There are, of course, still these scientists today, regretfully, the Duke University people are in their forefront, who reject the terrific underlying implications of the Carrie White affair, like the Flatlands Society, the Rosicrucians, or the Corallis of Arizona, who are positive that the atomic bomb does not work. These unfortunates are flying in the face of logic with their heads in the sand, and beg your pardon for the mixed metaphor. Of course, one is able to understand the consternation, the raised voices, the angry letters and arguments at scientific convocations. The idea of telekinesis itself has been a bitter pill for the scientific community to swallow. With its horror movie trappings of Ouija boards and mediums and table wrappings and floating coronets. But understanding will still not excuse scientific irresponsibility. The outcome of the White Affair raises grave and difficult questions. An earthquake has struck our ordered notions of the way the natural world is supposed to act and react. Can you blame even such a renowned physicist as Gérald Louponnet for claiming the whole thing is a hoax and a fraud? Even in the face of such overwhelming evidence as the White Commission presented? For if Carrie White is the truth, then what of Newton? They sat in the living room, Carrie and Mama, listening to Tennessee Ernie Ford singing "Let the Lower Lights Be Burning" on a Webcore phonograph, which Mama called the Victrola, or, if in a particularly good mood, the Vic. Carrie sat at the sewing machine, pumping with her feet as she sewed the sleeves on a new dress. Mama sat beneath the plaster crucifix, tatting doilies and bumping her feet in time to the song, which was one of her favorites. Mr. P.P. Bliss, who had written this hymn, and others seemingly without number, was one of Mama's shining examples of God at work upon the face of the earth. He had been a sailor and a sinner, two terms that were synonymous in Mama's lexicon. A great blasphemer, a laugher in the face of the Almighty. Then a great storm had come up at sea. The boat had threatened to capsize, and Mr. P.P. Bliss had gotten down on his sin-sickly knees with a vision of hell yawning beneath the ocean floor to receive him, and he had prayed to God. Mr. P.P. Bliss promised God that if he saved him, he would dedicate the rest of his life to him. The storm, of course, had cleared immediately. Brightly beams our Father's mercy from his lighthouse evermore, but to us he gives the keeping of the lights along the shore. All of Mr. P.P. Bliss's hymns had a sea-going flavor to them. The dress she was sewing was actually quite pretty, a dark wine color, the closest Mama would allow her to red, and the sleeves were puffed. She tried to keep her mind strictly on her sewing, but of course it wandered. The overhead light was strong and harsh and yellow. The small, dusty plush sofa was, of course, deserted. Carrie had never had a boy in to sit. And on the far wall was a twin shadow, the crucified Jesus, and beneath him, Mama. The school had called Mama at the laundry, and she had come home at noon. Carrie had watched her come up the walk, and her belly trembled. Mama was a very big woman, and she always wore a hat. Lately, her legs had begun to swell, and her feet always seemed on the point of overflowing her shoes. She wore a black cloth coat with a black fur collar. Her eyes were blue and magnified behind rimless bifocals. She always carried a large black satchel purse, and in it was her change purse, her billfold, both black, a large King James Bible, also black, with her name stamped on the front in gold, and a stack of tracts secured with a rubber band. The tracts were usually orange and smearily printed. Carrie knew vaguely that Mama and Daddy Ralph had been Baptist once, but had left the church when they became convinced that the Baptists were doing the work of the Antichrist. Since that time, all worship had taken place at home. Mama held worship on Sundays, Tuesdays, and Fridays. These were called holy days. Mama was the minister, Carrie the congregation. Services lasted from 2 to 3 hours. Mama had opened the door and walked stolidly in. She and Carrie had stared at each other down the short length of the front hall for a moment, like gunfighters before a shootout. It was one of those brief moments that seem, fear, could it really have been fear in Mama's eyes? Much longer in retrospect.
Mama closed the door behind her. "You're a woman," she said softly. Carrie felt her face twisting and crumpling and could not help it. "Why didn't you tell me?" she cried. "Oh, Mama, I was so scared. And the girls all made fun and threw things and..." Mama had been walking toward her, and now her hand flashed with sudden limber speed. A hard hand, laundry calloused and muscled. It struck her backhand across the jaw, and Carrie fell down in the doorway between the hall and the living room, weeping loudly. "And God made Eve from the rib of Adam," Mama said. Her eyes were very large in the rimless glasses. They looked like poached eggs. She thumped Carrie with the side of her foot, and Carrie screamed, "Get up, woman. Let's us get in and pray. Let's us pray to Jesus for our woman weak, wicked, sinning souls. Mama!" The sobs were too strong to allow more. The latent hysterics had come out grinning and gibbering. She could not stand up. She could only crawl into the living room with her hair hanging in her face, braying huge, hoarse sobs. Every now and again, Mama would swing her foot. So they progressed across the living room toward the place of the altar, which had once been a small bedroom. "And Eve was weak, and..." "Say it, woman! Say it!"
"No, Mama, please help me."
The foot swung. Carrie screamed.
"And Eve was weak and loosed the raven on the world," Mama continued. "And the raven was called sin, and the first sin was intercourse. And the Lord visited Eve with a curse, and the curse was the curse of blood. And Adam and Eve were driven out of the garden and into the world, and Eve found that her belly had grown big with child." The foot swung and connected with Carrie's rump. Her nose scraped the wood floor. They were entering the place of the altar. There was a cross on a table covered with an embroidered silk cloth. On either side of the cross there were white candles. Behind this were several paint-by-the-numbers of Jesus and his apostles. To the right was the worst place of all, the home of terror, the cave where all hope, all resistance, will, and Mama's was extinguished. The closet door leered open. Inside, below a hideous blue bulb lit, was DeRoe's conception of Jonathan Edwards' famous sermon, "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." And there was a second curse, and the curse of childbearing, and Eve brought forth Cain in sweat and blood. Now Mama dragged her, half-crawling, down to the altar, where they both fell on their knees. Mama gripped Carrie's wrist tightly. And following Cain, Eve gave birth to Abel, having not yet repented of the sin of intercourse. And so the Lord visited Eve with a third curse, and this was the curse of murder. Cain rose up and slew Abel with a rock. And still Eve did not repent, nor all the daughters of Eve. And upon Eve did the crafty serpent found a kingdom of whoredoms and pestilences.
"Mama," she shrieked, "Mama, please listen. It wasn't my fault."
"Bow your head," Mama said. "Let's us pray."
"You should have told me."
Mama brought her hand down on the back of Carrie's neck, and behind it was all the heavy muscle developed by 11 years of slinging heavy laundry bags and trucking piles of wet sheets. Carrie's eye-bulging face jerked forward, and her forehead smacked the altar, leaving a mark and making the candles tremble.
"Let's us pray," Mama said softly, implacably.
Weeping and snuffling, Carrie bowed her head. A runner of snot hung pendulously from her nose, and she wiped it away. "If I had a nickel for every time she made me cry here," with the back of her hand.
"Oh, Lord," Mama declaimed hugely, her head thrown back. Help this sinning woman beside me here see the sin of her days and ways. Show her that if she had remained sinless, the curse of blood never would have come on her. She may have committed the sin of lustful thoughts. She may have been listening to rock and roll music on the radio. She may have been tempted by the Antichrist. Show her that this is your kind, vengeful hand at work, and no, let me go. She tried to struggle to her feet, and Mama's hand, as strong and pitiless as an iron manacle, forced her back to her knees.
And your sign that she must walk the straight and narrow from here on out if she is to avoid the flaming agonies of the eternal pit. Amen.
She turned her glittering, magnified eyes upon her daughter. Go to your closet now. No. She felt her breath go thick with terror.
Go to your closet. Pray in secret. Ask forgiveness for your sin.
I didn't sin, Mama. You sinned. You didn't tell me. And they laughed. Again she seemed to see a flash of fear in Mama's eyes, gone as quickly and soundlessly as summer lightning. Mama began to force Carrie toward the blue glare of the closet.
Pray to God and your sins may be washed away.
Mama, you let me go.
Pray, woman.
I'll make the stones come again, Mama. Mama halted. Even her breath seemed to stop in her throat for a moment, and then the hand tightened on her neck, tightened until Carrie saw red, lurid dots in front of her eyes and felt her brain go